Busy city life makes it hard to think about and work at integrating our faith with our lives. Welcome to the Cathedral Podcast, produced and hosted by Jenny Ho Huan. Each episode, we want to help you relate core Christian truths to your daily life. Whether it's science, philosophy, cultural trends, or life stories, we bring you authentic and unrehearsed conversations to spark insight and strengthen your faith and your life.
Hi everyone, it's Jenny again. So good to have you back here with me at the Cathedral Podcast. I wonder what you think of when you hear the word ethics. I remember when I first heard that word, I thought it was to do with stuff like euthanasia, bribery, and difficult subject matters that would not concern me, especially at that time when I was 18 years old. But, you know, ethics is actually a lot more than that. Ethics is actually a field of study, also known as moral philosophy. And today, we have someone who has studied ethics with us. His name is Nathaniel Goh, and he is currently the youth and young adult pastor at Sengkang Methodist Church and also is understudying our ethics professor at Trinity Theological College. Welcome, Nat.
Thanks, Jenny. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, okay, let's begin with my problem as an 18-year-old, and it's still a bit of a lingering problem. Why bother to study ethics? It's so far out there and so, like, you know, all so theoretical and stuff.
Well, yes, ethics can sometimes be seen as a study of moral quandaries, which often have very little to do with us, or we feel has little to do with us. For example, debates about the justification of using nuclear weapons,
right,
for one. And in Singapore, as most Singaporeans don't really grapple with that question, because we don't have nuclear weapons to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Or questions about euthanasia and so on. So it seems to be a really huge kind of
big issues,
big moral quandaries that don't really relate to 90% of the population, maybe, or 80% of the population.
Or you guys sit around and talk about how all Cretans are liars.
Yeah,
so
that's
are the Cretans telling the truth?
That's right. But I think that ethics really is a reflection on moral action. And moral action, and all human acts are moral acts in a sense, or all human acts have the capacity to be judged morally. And I think that is really the entryway into thinking about ethics for me personally.
So you're suggesting that, why did you distinguish human acts vis-a-vis
other
animal acts.
Yeah, other creaturely acts in that sense.
Right, right.
Human acts are intelligible because of, in the Christian tradition, we think of the image of God, for example.
Mm.
So humans created in the image of God have rationality, have agency, moral agency in the world, and therefore what we do in the world in creation can be assessed from a moral standpoint.
Right. I mean, just at a practical level, what we do has an impact.
That's right.
Has a consequence.
Yeah.
So, okay, how would you speak to the whole popular notion right now that, you know, if it feels right to me, it makes sense for me, or to parents who say, you know, as long as my kids are happy. So how would you speak into that?
Well, you know, when you mention about parents, the first thing I'm thinking about is the current controversy going on in the US about celebrities and rich people who have paid for access to Ivy League schools.
Right.
So I don't want to cast aspersions on the intentions of parents, of course, but clearly that incident is an indicator that sometimes what our parents want for us or think is the best for us, and the means in which they employ to do that may not actually be right or just from a standpoint of
it may not even be the best thing for the kid.
That's right.
You know, if the classmates find out that that's how you got in,
yes.
Just imagine your experience, right?
Yeah.
And of course, for the rest of us who cannot afford to pay for the Ivy League schools, you know. So in your example, just illustrated that in a sense, our personal choices are not that personal or not that private either.
That's right. There's always a social aspect to our choices. That's one. I think I would be very reluctant to place emotions, to place our individual value judgments as the arbiter of the moral universe. So the question about, it feels right to me, why can't I do it? I think that those two things come together, the social aspect of who we are. So what we do has an impact in the world. We talked about that earlier. And secondly, the sense that the social aspect of our actions, as well as the fact that our emotions sometimes are not reliable guides for what we should do or the correct thing
does
to do.
Does the field of ethics actually have a sub-branch that looks into the whole emotional dimension of decision-making?
Yes, actually, one person that I would recommend, for example, is Thomas Aquinas.
Right.
And Thomas Aquinas' ethical scheme deals with moral psychology as well. It's very technical if you're reading it because...
Yeah, we need you to write a abridged version for us.
Yeah, as a philosophical work, I find it quite difficult to understand. But there are treatises about the will, for example, the will of a person, the passions of a person, the appetites of a person, and the intellect of a person. So he kind of looks at the anthropology of human desire.
That's fantastic, right? He brings out how complex we are as a being.
That's right. And he works it into an ethical system. And I think we do need to have exposure to that.
And sometimes we don't realize that maybe what our emotions want may not exactly be some other aspects of us, our history, or our future self may not want that.
That's right.
You know, so at that moment, what is the trump card that decides that our will goes one way or another? That self-awareness will be very critical. Mm-hmm. And I think having a schema like that would be very helpful. I wish they taught us that in school, isn't it?
Yes, I wish that too. We didn't learn much about him in seminary either.
Yeah, but I think there are maybe slightly more accessible books. Like, would you recommend something like Jonathan Haidt's book on, you know, thought life?
And I think he has one called The Righteous Mind. Is that?
Yes, something like, yes.
There are certainly many popular introductions to scheme. Something that Aquinas has been associated with is called virtue ethics.
Mm.
So really, any popular introduction, a Christian introduction to virtue ethics would be helpful as well. The writings of someone like Stanley Hauerwas, for example, would be also a good way of understanding virtue ethics from a certain standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's cool because really, if you bump into anybody on the street and you say, you know, what do you want in life? We all want to live some kind of meaningful, safe and relatively happy life, right? And that's common to all of us. Mm. So how do we navigate our choices and decisions ethically so that what's happy and meaningful for me is not derived at the expense of somebody else's safety, meaningfulness and happiness, right?
Yes. Yeah. There's this famous account in, I think it's Plato's Republic, about this thing called the Ring of Gyges, where, I think it's Glaucon or someone who says that if you had a ring that rendered you invisible to people, you would act in unjust ways because the unjust life is so much more meaningful and
attractive,
happy. You can do whatever you want and not get caught.
Yeah, and exactly. Prankster's dream
kind of,
come true.
Yeah, Socrates or Plato through Socrates pushes back against that to say that, you know, actually the just life, the virtuous life is the good life.
Mm.
And that's something that Christian theologians like Augustine and Aquinas and just threw on, even you could argue even Paul, you know, when he talks about the vice lists and the virtues of the Christian life, they kind of emphasize a certain formation in character and that is for them a good life.
That's interesting you brought that up about what Paul says about the vice and virtue list.
Mm.
Because it tells us, therefore, because Paul is writing to Christians, that even for Christians, it's an ongoing journey. This whole vice and virtue is an ongoing journey of making choices to say there is a vision of a good life, there is a vision of a moral life, and it's not just for myself, it's for the larger good of humanity or society or my family or community. And there's this constant choice that needs to be made, that we are aware there's a line, C.S. Lewis says, there's a line that runs down our hearts, right? The line of darkness and light. And on nearly every day, we're all making moral choices.
That's right.
Yeah. So what do you tell some of your young people then in church, some of the moral dilemmas they face at their age?
Well, a lot of what I like to tell young people is can be summed up in two things. One, that God is not done with you at any single point in your life. So there is nothing that you can screw up so badly in which the possibility of grace and redemption is outside of you. I think that's something, that's a message that young people need to know. So because we often paint the Christian life as a series of rules, or a series of things, lines or OB markers which you cannot transgress. And transgressing those makes you fall away from, you know, grace. Or, and I think I just want to remind them that even in the area of morality, it is a journey of sanctification. Mm. Acquiring virtue does not happen immediately. It takes time for that to come be embodied. So that's one.
Mm. That's so good. In our performance-oriented society, it's so important to remember we cannot fall outside grace.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. What else do I tell young people? I tell them that every act that we do, it may seem counterintuitive. On one hand, I emphasize grace. On the other hand, I want to emphasize the seriousness with which some moral philosophers call indifferent acts, which is, we think that those are not imbued with any kind of moral significance. Right. I'm walking on the street, I have a piece of tissue in my hand, I'll just dump it somewhere. And we don't really think, we don't agonize over, oh no, is this justice, you know, or is this a bad habit? But if we think about it, when we come to a point where we make a decision, let's say a huge one, I decide to divorce my wife, for example. Mm. When I come to that time when I'm about to make that decision, usually it doesn't happen in terms of a cause and effect way where I think I have a moral principle and I'm going to act on it. Usually it's a series of combinations of different, what we call morally indifferent acts, you know, over time that have shaped a certain person to respond in a certain way. And right. I think I want to remind them that the Christian life is about forming our character, our Christ-likeness, in such a way that when the time of crisis occurs, we have a reserve of powers of the soul, which are what virtues are, to act rightly, to act in accordance with God's will. I think that's what I'd like to remind them, that there are some things that you think are very unimportant, but over time, accumulating them makes you in a position where you might act rightly or wrongly.
Exactly. I so agree with you. It reminds me of that passage in Ephesians 6 that talks about being able to stand on the day of evil. Mm. And that last bit comes after you have been busy putting on the armor. Mm, so it's a whole series of intentional, disciplined efforts that, hey, I'm going to think right about this. I'm going to watch my heart. And I mean, the whole, every piece of the armor is really a reflection of the complexity of the human being. Yeah. And that if we take good care of ourselves and start making the small decisions, when the big decisions come, we will have a certain clarity. And I love what you say, you have a certain moral muscle to then endure and then to pick the right choice.
Yes.
Wow, that's such a good thing. I think every young person, I hope everybody is listening to this podcast. Yeah, so important that because, you know, I think sometimes I was once very young, so sometimes we just let things slide, you know, like, it's okay to be late, it's okay to not go to church, it's okay to not tithe, or it's okay to be rude to my mom, or whatever. But these things are costing us something over time. Wow, thank you so much, man. Okay, then maybe you can talk us through a bit more of this whole process of building moral muscle. What are some, maybe for a young person listening to us now, what are some intentional things that they can look out for? Danger zones and habits they can start inculcating in their life so that they can get to a point where they feel more confident when they have to confront ethical decisions. So if they are asked to sign a petition about this or that, how do they decide?
Well, I think the first thing that I want to remind listeners would be that the church in its various instantiations or various expressions throughout the world and in time has a body of moral reflection and tradition. And so I want to kind of push back against the idea that, in one sense, moral acts, we are responsible for our own moral acts. But we don't have to be the burden of making a moral judgment and having all the information doesn't have to be placed on us alone. We do have recourse to resources. Even the podcast, for example, is one addition to that resource in which we can add to our moral calculus.
That's good.
I think I want to remind listeners about that. The church exists for that reason, to form us as a community.
Right.
So how do we journey to the point where we can confront ethical decisions or how we make those decisions? I think the first thing I would say would be to immerse yourself into the life and the tradition of the church, the local church. And it's there where we learn the grammar of Christian language. That's where we learn the performance of Christian habits. Mm. That's where we see moral exemplars every day struggling with issues or with suffering and with pain and how they are coming through it in their Christian life. And all of that coming together enables us to grow in a certain way so that we can address moral issues properly. I think that that's something that I really want to highlight above everything else.
I think very important, because our society now is, the trend is to just go isolate yourself and do your own thing all the time. And that actually is a very vulnerable space to be in. But being in a community, being involved in the prayer, the whole spiritual realities, the habits, watching other people's lives, how things are playing out in their lives, getting support, having conversations is so crucial. So what about if you were to speak with other youth and young adult pastors, what would be some practical stuff you say? These are a few must-haves you must do in your youth young adult ministry to help your kids with this whole moral dimension of their lives.
Well, to be honest, I've been compared to you, for example, your tremendous pastoral experience. I've been a pastor full-time for just over 15 months. Oh. So I would be cautious about being too... of extrapolating my experience.
Sure. Not to be prescriptive, just to share.
But I think what has worked for me been this, the sense that, because I mentioned that one of the things that I always emphasize is that God is not done with you. And so... that being the case, I can accept where you are in life. If you are having a struggle, for example, with promiscuity, I am. You can tell me about it and I won't excommunicate you. I don't have the power to excommunicate anyone. I try to do two things, basically. One is to create the openness where they can tell me anything or tell the church anything. I think it is precisely in the church that we should be open to accepting that people are broken and scarred. I think the sense that I have from growing up in different churches and not just any one church is that we had a certain kind of Victorian
triumphalistic
of what Christian life should be like.
Yeah.
And if anyone was struggling, it was difficult to express that in public because, hey, why aren't you living the victorious Christian life? So I think that's the first bit. We want to come to a point where our churches, really broken people are coming into the churches and accepting that we are amongst other broken people. Yep. We are all kind of wounded healers, if that's the term Henry Nouwen uses. That's one. I think two, also the sense that after this, after acknowledging where we are, there is a desire to get things right.
Yes.
And there's a desire for things to change. And that's where we come in. Accountability, for example, in the Wesleyan tradition, that has been a tremendous form of grace for us in changing our lives.
Yeah, bring back the holy clubs, man.
Yeah, that's right. You know, yes. So I think those two things are what we humanly do. And of course, above and standing over and above all of this is the power of the Holy Spirit in His church. And I really believe in that. I really believe in the power of the Holy Spirit for change, for transformation. And I think that's something that also perhaps we might need to bring up a little bit more. That the moral life is not just a struggle to grow yourself, like going to the gym. Yes, there is that analogy, but over and this is the very power of God working in and through us and in the church. Mm. And I think sometimes we neglect that. We make the Christian life sound so difficult and of our own volition, our own power. And I want to emphasize that it really is grace. It really is the Holy Spirit at work.
Well, yeah, that routes back to another Pauline verse about in Philippians about how God is at work in us to both to will and to want and to work out.
That's right.
His goodwill. Yeah, that's a very important point. But, you know, that won't apply to Manchester United, right? I understand you're a fan. How does the ethics of Premier League work out, man?
Well,
Premier League football.
Those
of you who are Liverpoolers out there, just bear with us for a while.
There are so many things...
It applies to you too, yes.
...about Premier League football that are ethically suspect.
Oh, yes.
Over the weekend, a fan ran onto the field, not in the Premier League, but in one of the lower leagues in England, and punched one of the players.
Oh, boy.
And
now they have to put up signs. Our players have the right to play safely in this stadium.
That's right. but it's it's indicative of the kind of tribalism that is alive in professional sport. And that's the one. That's one aspect that I really grapple with as an avid diehard fan of Manchester United. Let me just, as a sidetrack, this is a joke. Someone asked me if I had $1 billion, what would I do with my $1 billion, or if I had unlimited funds? And you know, the obvious thing is buy a football club, right? Yeah. But my joke was that I would buy Liverpool Football Club and erase them from the face of the earth.
Oh, yeah! Look at that darkness in your heart.
Yes,
brother,
right.
My, repent, man.
I should bringing this up towards the end of the podcast probably makes, you know, it's safer, but after this people might turn off. But I think in Premier League football there's questions of access, who has access to it. So fans paying money, for example, and exploitation of young players, shipping them over from their homes from Africa or Latin America or anywhere in the world, just so that they can find the next big thing. And then if they don't make it, they're just kind of cast by the wayside. There are many questions about Premier League football or professional sport as it's evolved that should cause us to give pause and think about the morality of it. On the other hand, there are the aesthetics of human skill, the aesthetics of human mastery of football, and as well as the kind of pure joy and enjoyment that comes from being part of that. I think there are many things to learn from Premier League football that the church could take into place.
Oh,
I've
really?
Attended a game at Old Trafford in Manchester, and it felt almost like a church service. We sang songs that are, because it's in England, so the hymns are hymn tunes.
Oh.
We sang chants that were hymn tunes, and everyone was in one voice, and they were all together. So I think, you know, those are aspects of communal life that the church can recover. And a certain, I think it was mentioned in your first podcast, the idea of joy in the Christian life.
Yes,
I think that is something that Premier League football, I mean, Manchester United, has brought me great joy over the years. I think that's something that Christians...
Yeah, whenever we go, everybody just
that's something
jumps
that
up and
the
down,
church
yeah.
and the moral life should be. It should be
a joyful life.
And I think just to end on that, I think that joy is the crowning virtue of Christian life. The birth of Jesus is announced in joy.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrews tells us that for the joy that was set before him, Jesus endured these things. The Psalms speak of the day of God's judgment, even as a day of rejoicing for creation. And so we need to recover that in ethics especially. The ethics is not just about rules and not just about you not doing this and not doing that, but it's about doing the good. Doing the good for what Aquinas would call the beatific vision, or what the philosophers called eudaimonia, a kind of flourishing joy. And I think that is something that I hope that listeners will take back, that the Christian life and morality is a life of joy. It's a life of pursuing God.
Mm.
And pursuing God is joy.
And God is joy.
God is joy.
Yeah.
So I think that is something that if there is only one thing you take back from this, not the Manchester United stuff, take back that, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm Man U fan, so I'll take it. But very, I understand the whole ethical dilemma with the clubs and all that, and it's part of a larger piece of how our whole world is just going that way very much, where everything is attached to dollar value and not the human life, but the human life can do.
That's right.
And all that, and it's actually really painful. But so important that precisely as Christians, we can speak into that. That we have a vision of life where life is valued as is, because it's created by God.
Mm.
God wanted you here, and God gave you those gifts, or God gave you those limitations even. And if the ethics of life, wanting to grow in virtue, is because the virtues help us to come to experience that vision of life.
That's right.
Rather than the virtues or the right and wrong help us to get in an entrance or an audience with God. It's never been that.
Mm.
It's been that God has made it possible for us to be on this journey where we can be, we can grow, mature, transform, be sanctified. Yeah, thank you so much for talking with us. Before we go, a little verse from 1 John 3:10, because I've been doing this Bible study with my kids, you know, from the 1 John. And strikes me as this is how we know who the children of God are and who the children of the devil are. Anyone who does not do what is right is not God's child, nor is anyone who does not love their brother and sister. I want to end on the note that doing right or wrong is completely wound up with loving our brothers and sisters. There's always that dimension for us as Christians, that what is moral is offer, is what is loving as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Thank you for that reminder.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, Nat.
Thanks.
God bless.
Thank you for listening in. We hope you've been encouraged with some new thoughts on faith and life integration. You can find us on the Cathedral app, iTunes, Spotify, or at cathedral.org.sg/podcast. Be sure to join us again.